When a crisis comes and we or a loved one winds up in the operating room, we expect our surgeon to be awake, alert, highly skilled, all-knowing, and all-seeing. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. In her new book, A Few Small Moments, surgeon Carol Scott Connor helps us see what it's like on the other side of the scalpel, the aching hands and the aching feet, the sleepless nights, the feelings of power and the feelings of powerlessness, the horrors and the satisfaction of truly making a difference. The stories are fictional but true. I'll talk with her today about her book and her career in surgery. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Dr. Carol Scott Connor is a surgeon. She's a professor of surgery at the University of Iowa and a former head of the Department of Surgery. When she was appointed to that post in 1995, she became only the second woman in American surgery to be a department head. For decades, her work has been repairing bodies and teaching students. But now she's published a collection of fictional short stories. It's called A Few Small Moments. And Dr. Scott Connor, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Charity. It's my pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about your career first. You went to New York University College of Medicine. In 1976, you graduated from there?
Yes, that's correct. And then I stayed there for my surgical residency. You know, Charity, when I started medical school, I thought I wanted to be a neuroscientist or maybe a cardiologist. I never envisioned being a surgeon, and yet it was probably the most natural career choice looking back. I started my third year when you go into your clinical clerkships and you start being on the wards. I started with surgery because I knew I didn't want to be a surgeon, so I figured I would practice and get good at it. And then when I got to the other clerkships that mattered, I'd be really
in good shape.
So I fell in love with it. And I think the things that made me fall in love with it, in retrospect, it all kind of makes sense. I like doing things with my hands. I like the immediate nature of surgery. You make a diagnosis, you go in there, you do something with your hands, and you help someone. Most of the time we do help patients. And then you see the results, and it's very satisfying. And I decided to be a surgeon, so...
When you decided to become a surgeon, were there other women in the program with you who decided to take the same path?
Not really. There might have been a couple in my medical school class. It was a relatively large class with a fairly high percent of women. I don't know the exact numbers. But there weren't any women on the faculty at NYU where I was in medical school, none in surgery at that time. And there were only a couple in the surgery residency program. So it wasn't a well-trodden path for a woman.
Since it wasn't what you were planning to do in the first place, and you felt yourself drawn to surgery, you were pretty much alone as a female. Did you struggle with that?
I think that I had a little bit of preparation because my undergraduate college was MIT. And at MIT, there were only 30 women in the freshman class of 900. So I was sort of used to being a minority from the basis of gender. Once I made the decision and got into the residency, the thing about surgery residency at that point is that it was really a very difficult residency for everyone, man or woman. And so we were all sort of in the same boat. And that made it easier in a way.
Did you feel discriminated against at all because you were a woman by faculty members that you were interacting with?
I really didn't. I felt like we were all treated very much the same. Now, I have to say, Charity, when I look back on my career in retrospect and with the sensitivity that I've developed over the years, certainly I can identify instances where there were things said or, you know, little behavior patterns that did indicate discrimination, but I wasn't aware of it, and I don't think it really hampered me as I was going through.
Let's go back to that first surgical rotation that you did where you realized that you really loved surgery. Do you remember a moment from that that really got you hooked?
Well, there were two things that were very vivid. I was the last part of the last class at NYU to do their clerkships in the old Bellevue Hospital. And the old Bellevue had a big open plan emergency room where all the patients just came in on gurneys and lay in rows one after the other. Patient privacy wasn't a consideration, and they were all pretty sick. And the surgical chief resident would sit at this big desk on a raised platform at one end of the ER, and at the far end of the ER was the slot that the ambulance would bring the trauma patients in, the most seriously injured. And he would just sit there and wait. And when a trauma patient came in, he would jump over the desk that he was sitting behind and just run down there. He just couldn't wait to get to it. And, you know, it was just that eagerness and that sense of excitement, the sense of that it was a very important job, that he really enjoyed it, and that there was nowhere else he wanted to be. It was absolutely infectious.
Well, there must be so much adrenaline involved in dealing with trauma patients.
There is. There's a lot of adrenaline, and people who do emergency medicine and trauma surgery really run on adrenaline, and that's what keeps you going and keeps you at your peak, yes.
In the stories that you've written, you write a lot about the very long hours, the overnights, the trauma. And I can imagine as a young surgeon that would be exciting. As time goes on, I can just imagine that it would also be completely exhausting. How do you stay engaged after years and years of that kind of grueling schedule?
Well, I really believe that careers evolve over time. And I think that if you're fortunate, you can shape your career path. And I think I was very fortunate to allow change and growth so that when I became a department head, for example, I spent a little less time in the operating room. I still took night call, and I was still covering trauma and burns and all that. So I still had all that nighttime activity. But during the day, I might not be in the operating room the next day. The fact is that as you get older, it does get more difficult. And some of the stories in the book deal with the fact that as I got older, you know, I got to the point where the adrenaline, which had kept me going through all those nights, really kind of started giving me physiological problems. And you just have to adapt your schedule. I don't take night call anymore. I operate during the day, and I do primarily breast surgery. And the people who do trauma are the younger surgeons.
As your career evolved, did the pleasure, I guess pleasure is maybe a tricky word here, but the pleasure that you derived from doing a successful surgery, did that evolve as well? Did the feelings that you felt when you did surgery change for you?
I think there is some evolution. I think when you're a young surgeon, the technical aspects of the surgery are still so engaging that you get a great deal of satisfaction from the technical aspects of a difficult operation well performed. As the decades go by and the technical aspects become more familiar, then the satisfaction switches a little bit and starts to involve the engagement with the patient and the individual story for the patient and the journey that the patient's going through.
Where does writing fit in for you? Because obviously you've written books and many technical articles about surgical procedures and other research over the years. This is a collection of fictional stories. For you, what role has writing played in your life as a surgeon?
I really wanted to share the experience. And people had been saying, you ought to write your memoirs, you ought to write your memoirs. Well, writing memoir is difficult, and writing it objectively is probably impossible. I thought that if I wrote stories, and I think of this almost as a kind of memoir in the form of stories because it's very true to the experience, gave me more freedom and made it easier to preserve confidentiality and so on. But I wanted people to understand what it was like. It's been a wonderful trip for me, and I just wanted to share that.
Was writing something that you always did? And of course, you're going to find as people read your book, a lot of people understand that the main character through most of your stories, Dr. Beth Abernathy, has a lot of similarities to you, and a lot of us are going to think that she is you. And I'm sure since these are fictional stories, there are some differences as well. But she writes and puts her thoughts down on paper, and that's a therapeutic thing for her. Is that something that you've always done?
I've done it for a long time, and I think that it's something that a lot of people in the medical professions do, and actually we're incorporating into the medical curriculum now because people realize that it's a way of organizing your thoughts and maintaining that connection to humanity. I kind of think of Beth Abernathy as my better self, you know, and sometimes I think, what would she say or what would she do? She seems to be more patient than I am in many ways.
When you were writing these stories, did you conceive of it as a whole, or is this something that has gradually come together over the years?
It started as a novel. I wanted to write a novel, and I had a lot of difficulty with the technical aspects of maintaining the arc of a story and so on. So then I started doing short stories. And after I had published about 12 or 13 of them, I thought it was time to bring them together as a collection. So then I coalesced them and tried to create an arc of an overall cycle of stories.
Well, and it really does read much like a novel. I mean, we have the same characters throughout, and she's moving through time and evolving and changing. So there really is they are of a whole, but you've been writing them separately for how long?
Probably about 15 years now.
When you sit down to write, are there any parallels between writing a story, putting your thoughts on paper, and performing a surgery?
Probably, in that, you know, you're going in to do a task. I find that when I'm writing, whether it's technical writing, textbooks, or stories, I spend a lot of time thinking. And the actual writing the first draft can be pretty fast once it's in my mind. And that's probably very similar to an operation. You know, you plan it ahead of time. You think about what you're going to do, and then you go and do it.
My guest today is Dr. Carol Scott Connor. She is the author of a collection of short stories. It's called A Few Small Moments. And in the story, she takes us to the other side of the scalpel to help us understand what it's like to be a surgeon, what it's like to be in the head and the body of a surgeon. And we'll find out more about these stories in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guest today is Dr. Carol Scott Connor. She's a surgeon and has been a surgeon for more than three decades, and she has put out now a collection of fiction, a collection of short stories. It's called A Few Small Moments, and they are stories about life as a surgeon. They take us into the operating room, and for those of us who have ever been on the table, really show us a slice of life on the other side, above the scalpel. And we were talking before the break about Dr. Beth Abernathy as kind of being possibly your alter ego, and you think of her as your better self in some ways. In the beginning of the book, you introduce us to a young surgeon, and her name is Alex. And when I was reading about her, I found myself wondering if she also was a part of you.
I think Alex is definitely part of me. I brought her on board in the stories as sort of a prototype of many young surgeons who are developing their skills. They're just out into independence as a surgeon for the first time. And maybe because they're a little bit insecure, they sometimes can come across as arrogant. And often get themselves into trouble by saying things they shouldn't say, swearing, and so forth and so on. And certainly I had a lot of those characteristics when I started out. So she's kind of my younger, brasher self, yes.
Well, and as you describe her in the book, she has very little tolerance for other people's mistakes. And she loses her temper a lot. There have been a lot of complaints at the hospital from people, other nurses, other people that she works with, also from patients, because she has lost her temper and said things that she really shouldn't have said. There's a stereotype of surgeons, though, as being arrogant, as feeling that they're better than others, other doctors and other people. Is there some truth to that stereotype?
I think there definitely is. And there's a very fine line that you have to tread, because when you go into the operating room, when you take someone into surgery, you really have to believe in your heart and soul that you're the very best person to operate on that other human being. They're going to be put to sleep. You're going to cut them open. You're going to do things that can change their life. And you have to feel totally confident. You have to be able to get what you need for the patient. If an instrument's not there, you have to get someone to get it. If they're slow getting it, you have to get them to speed up. And there's definitely a way of working with the team in the operating room and anticipating your needs and so forth and so on that you learn as you get older. But when you're young, you don't necessarily have that. So you find yourself asserting yourself in inappropriate ways. And that's something that a lot of young surgeons struggle with.
Well, it sounds like something, not only something that they struggle with, but it sounds like something that almost might be necessary to be a good surgeon, to have this lack of tolerance for other people's mistakes or for mistakes in general.
Well, you can't tolerate a mistake. You really can't. You know, think of it, you're the patient going into the operating room. If something happens, you don't want somebody, oh, that's okay, don't feel bad about it. You want it to be an error-proof system. I think what we've learned over the years and what you learn as you grow as a surgeon is that you have to build that environment with the team where errors are not going to happen. And you do that by anticipating what you're going to need so that you tell them 10 minutes ahead of time that you're going to need a certain instrument or that you're going to need something. Give them plenty of time to get it. Tell the anesthesiologist that you might get into some bleeding so that they're alerted. And so everybody knows what the game plan is. And that's how you make it safe. And the more stress-free you can make it for everyone in an inherently stressful environment, the better it's going to go.
All of these scenes in the book take place in a teaching hospital, or the scenes that take place in the hospital are in a teaching hospital. And so Dr. Beth Abernathy is constantly working with residents, with students who are learning to be surgeons. And there are several different moments in the book where the resident will express doubt about something. But what if this happens? What if this is the worst case scenario and things get out of control? And several times you show Dr. Abernathy's discipline in not allowing her brain to go there.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's a funny thing, Charity. You need to have a plan in place for all eventualities, including the worst case scenarios. But if you dwell on all the worst case outcomes, you almost will become paralyzed and unable to take the right action. So you have to walk confidently. It's like if you could imagine walking on a 2-foot wide platform across a gulf. You can walk as far as you want across any space on a 2-foot wide platform. You're not going to fall. But if you think about the distance you might fall on either side, you could become paralyzed and unable to do anything. So you have to be mindful of all the possibilities, but move forward confidently.
Well, as I mentioned in the beginning of the book, you write about Alex and this young surgeon and her arrogance and vulnerability. And as things go on, you show us a little bit of Dr. Beth Abernathy's vulnerability as well. And of course, she is the head of surgery, and she is the person who is in charge of disciplining this young surgeon, Alex, when she gets out of line. And yet, after coming down quite hard on Alex, she has a moment where she realizes how vulnerable she herself is. And I was wondering if you could read us some of that. And this is in a story. The story is, I'll get to the beginning of the story. We're going to go quite deep in it, but it's a section called Achilles' Heel. And give us a little bit of background before we get to the reading of I've talked about the conflict between Alex and Dr. Abernathy, but there's a patient who comes in.
Yes. The story up until this point has involved Alex getting herself into trouble by being in the operating room. Something goes awry, and she loses her temper. So she's called into Beth Abernathy's office, and they have an encounter. And then as penalty, she's assigned to a clinic that she doesn't enjoy, and there her patience is even tried further, which is sort of ironic. But then we have a scene with Dr. Abernathy where she is doing surgery, and then something happens afterwards that causes her to explode. And that explosion reminds Beth that surgeons just happens sometimes, and you have to learn how to cope with it. So I'm going to read just a little bit. This is a scene in the surgery suite with Beth Abernathy doing surgery on a young woman with a small breast mass that everybody thinks is probably benign. The tiled surfaces of the minor room reverberated like a Gothic cathedral with the lilting strains of the waltz of the Sugar Plum Fairies. Sound spilled out into the small antechamber with the scrub sinks, lifting Beth's spirits as she adjusted her surgical mask before entering the small OR. As Beth entered, Soraya turned toward the door and smiled. Soraya lay flat on the operating table, her headscarf meticulously adjusted and her bed covered with sheets. Her slight form barely tented up the covers. "Let me take a quick feel, refresh my memory," Beth said, expertly lowering the sheets and lifting the surgical gown to uncover just a small amount of territory around the areola while keeping everything else covered, preserving the illusion of modesty. Beth felt the lump there. It hadn't gone away. "We'll make the incision right there," she thought, and nodded. As she worked, Beth could hear Roberta's voice on the other side of the drapes murmuring, engaging Soraya in conversation. Just as Beth's task was to do a workmanlike job of removing the lump and closing the incision, Roberta's task was to look after Soraya, to monitor her vital signs, her comfort level, and to keep her distracted. "Many people wonder why I wear the hijab, the veil. I have been asked if I am a novitiate, a nun, or if my father or my husband made it do it," Soraya was saying to Roberta. "No one makes me do anything. I have studied at Oxford, at Harvard. Now I come here to work in the best lab in the world with people doing groundbreaking work in gender specificity in pharmacokinetics. The hijab is my choice. It is a symbol. It protects me, a barrier between me and the world of sin. It goes back to the time when the Prophet Muhammad's wives began to cover themselves in public in order to command respect." It occurred to Beth that she was almost as thoroughly covered up as Soraya. The only part of Beth that was exposed was a narrow band above her mask, her eyes and eyebrows, and another narrow band at her neck above the gown. Abruptly, Beth recalled a few lines she had written as a medical student. "The case goes badly, and I, masked and veiled, covered from head to toe like a Berber tribeswoman, am sent out to beg blood." She wondered if she still had the notebook at home with that poem. Third year of residency, what year would that be? She looked down at her hands, fingers curled around the Leahy clamp she was using to retract the edges of the wound. Right hand for precision, left hand for strength. The small joints in the fingers of her left hand ached briefly when she relaxed her grip. The knuckles had begun to swell about a year ago. too many years of pulling, tugging, putting more stress on those joints than they were engineered to handle. She needed to find a different way to retract the tissue, shift the stress to another part of her hand. There, the lump was out. Now we shift forward 2 days. The path report comes back, and it's adenocarcinoma. And the pathologist tells Beth that although he can make the diagnosis of cancer, he can't do some critical assays that need to be done because the tissue was submitted as benign tissue rather than as cancer. It wouldn't be a problem now, but at the time that this occurred, it would be. So he says, sorry, we can't do receptors. The specimen wasn't processed properly. What? We can't do receptors. We're outside parameters. The lump sat over the weekend in formalin. We can't run the assay. Son of a bitch, that's not acceptable. This is a person we're dealing with, not a piece of meat that's gone past expiration date. Run it anyway. And so she explodes.
And you show a moment where she was feeling confident because she was certain that this young woman had a benign lump. She had written the story in her mind. This was a young, healthy woman. And then it turned out that she was wrong.
Yes, that's correct. And then she has to find a way with the pathologist to get the critical assays done so that the information isn't lost. But then when she later meets with Alex, that memory of her own loss of control is fresh in her mind, and it tempers her encounter.
We were just listening to Carol Scott Connor reading from her collection of short stories. It's called A Few Small Moments, and they're short stories about life as a surgeon. They are fictional stories, although they certainly read as truth. And you must have been very careful when writing these stories to get the technical details right.
Yes. I think the technical details are probably the easy part. The kind of textbooks that I write are about surgical technique, how to do operations. So that's the easy part. The thing that becomes more difficult is putting in the reality of what it is like with the encounter with a patient and yet not disclosing anything actual, you know, making patients that are composite, that are true to the sorts of things that we encounter. This patient with the benign breast lump, I mean, this is something that we encounter sometimes. We'll see someone young, a college student, we think it's benign, and we want to believe it's benign.
You really paint a picture of a dichotomy for a surgeon between the person that they're operating on the operating table and the person that the patient really is. And in this story, we don't see it so much because Soraya, the patient, can speak and talk, and the doctor is involved with her during the surgery. But there are many moments during the book where the person on the table is unconscious. They can't speak. You may have never spoken to them before. And then later you have to deal with the reality of who this person is. Is that a strange dichotomy for a surgeon?
It can be. I think that we are trained when a patient is on the operating table, we really don't think of them as a person. It's part of the coping mechanism that lets you actually take a knife and cut into their flesh. You know, it's a problem to be solved. But it is often the case in emergency surgery, in trauma surgery, that you may take a patient to the operating room that you may not even have spoken to. You don't know them, you don't know their story, and you only get to know them afterwards. And it is very strange to get to know them. It's part of the job.
There are a couple of different stories where you really demonstrate how you have to compartmentalize not just your whole life, because you obviously have to do that. You can't bring a lot of baggage with you into the operating room, but even within a surgery. One of those moments was a trauma patient who came in who had been in a car accident. He was in his 30s. He had been thrown. He was not wearing a seatbelt. He had been thrown free from the car, flown 20 feet or something like that, and landed obviously very hard. This was an interstate car accident. And the surgeon in the story is operating on him on his abdomen at the same time he has a very badly broken leg and a head injury. And your main character can't look at the leg, can't think about the head. She just has to fix him and later discovers that his head injury is something that he can never recover from. And that, I guess we don't think about the fact that you're not even treating the whole person that you have there in front of you. You have to take care of what you can do.
And you have to be aware of the entire situation. But that's a very, unfortunately, that happens in trauma. Sometimes people come in with head injuries. We don't know how bad it is. We have to make a decision. What injury do we treat first? What's the most immediate threat to life? And then you just have to go in there and do it as quickly and as well as you can and stabilize them. And then afterwards, you may find that the outcome is not what you would have liked because of the severity of the head injury.
I am sure that there are some people who would read that and think, what a terrible waste of time and resources, because this person could not have survived. Is there a feeling of that sometimes? Like we just spend hours working on this person, but...
You know, that's an interesting question. I don't really think so. I think it's more a feeling of a sense of the imperfect nature of the art that we practice, that we can fix some things, but there are other things that we can't fix. And the frustration at not being able to fix some of these things.
I'm talking with Dr. Carol Scott Connor. She is a surgeon. She's a professor of surgery at the University of Iowa. And she's also now the author of a collection of short stories. It's called A Few Small Moments. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and I'm here today with Dr. Carol Scott Connor. She's a surgeon. She has been a surgeon for more than three decades. She's a professor of surgery at the University of Iowa. She'd also served as the head of the Department of Surgery at the University of Iowa in the past. And she has published a book of fictional short stories. It's called A Few Small Moments. And I want you to read from one of the stories again in just a moment, but before we get there, before the break, we were talking about this compartmentalization that surgeons seem to have to do, and you write about that in the book, how before the break we were talking about how Dr. Abernathy had to focus on just one part of a patient, knowing that there were other problems that she couldn't take care of at that moment. There's another story that you write about a man who comes in with a terrible shotgun wound to his abdomen. And, you know, the doctor is doing the surgery and healing this man. It looks like he's going to survive. And at some point during the medical procedure, she learns that he's a pedophile. And it's very likely that someone shot him. And one of the people in the operating room with her makes the comment, he probably had it coming. Is that something that you've had to struggle with over the years? If you find out something about this patient, how do you separate what you know from what you need to do to save them?
Well, again, that's something you learn. And I trained at Bellevue Hospital, and we had a lot of very strange stories come through Bellevue. And one of the things that we always said at Bellevue is you just don't ask how they got shot or who shot who. You just take them to the OR and fix them up. So it's, again, something you learn in your training. It's not an encounter that happens very commonly here in Iowa. Fortunately, what's one of the things I really like about living in Iowa. And that story wasn't based on an Iowa incident. It really goes back many, many years. But yeah, you have to deal with them as a human being. That's the healing contract, is that you will deal with everyone who comes to you as a human being, whether they're friend or enemy or whoever they might be.
And after these surgeries, the doctor has to talk to the family,
mm-hmm.
or whoever might be representing this person. That must be an extraordinary experience to go from the operating room to sort of plunge yourself into these emotionally charged situations that can be waiting for you out in the hallway.
Yes, and it's particularly difficult, I think, with the emergency cases, with the trauma cases, where the family has been suddenly snatched from their normal routine into a really terrifying new world. They don't even know what's happened to their loved one. And you just have to keep bringing it back to what you know. And I think I'm naturally a glass half full person, so I always try to think of things that are encouraging, even when the situation is bleak, things that are a little bit hopeful, and take it step by step and meet them at the place that they are in their lives.
You write about Dr. Abernathy feeling like she has a very hard shell around her.
Yes, and that was something I became aware of probably in the last decade or so, is that you do, because you develop defense mechanisms, you do develop this shell, and you feel like it's getting thicker and thicker, and sometimes you just need to shed some of that old skin and let it thin out a little.
Were there times in your career when you were afraid you'd lost the ability to feel?
I think so. I mean, I think certainly there are times when you're doing a lot of that sort of emergency work, or when a lot of emotionally intense experiences pile one after another, where you can become numb, and that's when you need to just step back. Writing, again, I think writing really helps, and whether it's just some writing that you never publish, or whether it's something that you're going to someday share with the world, I think that helps a lot.
There are a lot of hints of the emotional toll that this career can take on people, and there are several times during the course of the stories, the main character, like yourself, has been married for a very long time and seems to have a very happy marriage. But a lot of the other people that she encounters are just separated from their spouse or something like that. Do you see that in your world as a surgeon, that this kind of career takes a terrible toll on the personal lives of a lot of doctors?
I think it does. Certainly the older generations, my generation, there were a lot of broken marriages. I was married in medical school to a classmate, and my husband and I are still married, and he's been my bedrock, and he's part of what keeps me functioning and writing and so on. But a lot of people are not so lucky. It's very hard, very hard, yes.
Well, talking about this hard shell that you need to build about yourself as a surgeon and struggle with leads us very nicely into the next story that I'd like you to read a little bit of, and this is called The Ninth Life.
This is a story about the experience of, again, it's Beth Abernathy telling the story in first person with her husband, Jonathan, struggling with the death of one of their pet cats. And so February 2nd, when the story begins, they're going to euthanize all us aging baby boomers, I told Jonathan as we sat together over dinner at the kitchen table. They'll sugarcoat it, offer incentives, but you'll see. What? He said, looking up from the newspaper. I said, we're all going to be euthanized. That's how they'll solve the Medicare Social Security mess. Line us up, play nice music, off we go. The politicians, they're going to do it. Another 10 years, just wait. You're being silly. Just like the cat, I said. What about Pumpernickel? He carefully folded the newspaper and thumbed on the television, the Weather Channel. You keep asking me as if it's time to put her to sleep, as if I know. You're the surgeon, he said. I don't euthanize people, I thought, but I let it lie. I looked over to where Pumpernickel lay sprawled out on the floor by the heater vent. She was completely still. She's not breathing, I said. I bent over and lightly stroked one tattered ear. The ear twitched briskly, and Pumpernickel looked up and blinked at me. The cat's breathing. She was just sleeping, Jonathan said. Sorry, cat, I said. Pumpernickel stood up with extreme deliberation. She was skeletally thin, and her hair had started to come out in clumps. She had bald spots on the heels of her hind feet and had taken to standing on her hind toes, even at rest, as if it hurt less that way. I went over and warmed a small portion of Fancy Feast in the microwave, put it down on the floor. Pumpernickel was going on 20, and her kidneys had been failing for two years. She had been a stray kitten. When we first learned that she had kidney failure, we followed the vet's instructions precisely. We sprinkled powder on her food and inserted pills into little pill pockets cunningly made from fish paste. Nights, I'd hold her pinned on the kitchen floor between my thighs and inject her under the scruff of the neck with 150 mLs of Ringer's lactate while Jonathan monitored the injection volume. That was last autumn, when she still had her full strength. And then, one night, as she and I fought and she turned back to look at me, I thought, why? And so I put the needles away and never did it again. She wouldn't eat the kidney failure diet, and the powder seemed to take her appetite away, so we stopped giving it to her. She still ate the pill pockets, liked them better than her canned cat food, so we gave them to her for extra nutrition, but we didn't put any pills inside them. It couldn't be long. This bitterly cold winter, it finally came down to watching to see if she had stopped breathing. The kitchen was the warmest room in the house. Even so, Pumpernickel had taken to sleeping next to the heater vent under the sink. Jonathan had made a heated bed for her out of a small sheepskin dog bed lined with an electric heating pad, but the cat preferred the floor in front of the sink. So towels were laid down, and we straddled her with our feet. I was the first to awaken most mornings, and I would go downstairs, half hoping that she had passed quietly in the night. For the past week, Jonathan had been talking about taking Pumpernickel for that final trip to the vet, but I prayed instead to the God of small animals for some final mercy, peaceful passage in the night. Isn't that what we all want?
Dr. Carol Scott Connor reading from her collection of short stories, A Few Small Moments. And I love that story so much because it does show Dr. Abernathy's vulnerability, but it also shows, you know, here's a woman who has to make split-second life or death decisions in her professional life. And then in her personal life, to make this decision is just too overwhelming to her. And in thinking about, you know, you were talking about that hard shell that you need to create around yourself as a surgeon to protect yourself. This is a moment that obviously breaks through and reminds the doctor of how much she loves and how much she feels. But also that feeling of helplessness, that must be, I would think, particularly difficult for a surgeon because you do have the power to save people's lives in so many cases.
Yes, and that's why we go into surgery. We like going in there with our hands and our brains and you know, fixing something, making it better. And so it's very frustrating to deal with these sorts of chronic problems that are just by their very nature going to get a little worse every day. And that story, the part about the cat was, I think, pretty clearly based on an experience that I had one of these really bad Iowa winters. And it was very difficult to make a decision. And it was striking to me that even though we had been married for so long, my husband and I were not quite on the same side of the decision. And it was just a tough time.
And it also probably gave you some insight into the decisions that the people that you work with sometimes, the families of patients, have
yes.
to make.
Yes. And, of course, you go through this in your own life as well. But somehow this playing out, I remember watching a TV program, a vet show, and the vet used the line, whatever decision you make will be the right one because it is made with love. And that's something that comes back to me and that I try to get across to people that are grappling with these tough decisions.
When you think about this collection of stories, now, and earlier in the program we talked about the fact that people had been encouraging you to write your memoir and you found that to be daunting. But obviously these stories have a lot of you and a lot of your experiences in them. When you think about the person sitting down with the book, what do you want your reader to learn from these stories?
I think what I wanted to get across is that women are surgeons, just like men, and it's a great job. We face the same problems and pressures as the men do. one of the things that people would ask me was, what can I recommend my young daughter read? She's thinking of going into medicine. She might want to be a surgeon. I would hear this from men who were surgeons. And many of the books that were written by women in surgery at least a couple decades ago were written from a place of bitterness, you know, their own difficulties. And I wanted to just get across the point that it's a great life. It's wonderful. It's endlessly fascinating and rewarding, and sure, there are challenges. But women do it just like guys do.
Well, and at the very end of the book, you say it's possible to have a balanced life. There was a time when women who went into surgery felt like they had to choose. And of course, in so many careers, there was this time where women had to choose, do I want to be a surgeon or do I want to be a wife and a mother?
Yes. And, you know, medical education in general, the fact that most of our medical students, or many of them, are married now, and 50% of them are women, and a lot of them already have young families. People have had to realize that you shouldn't have to give up your family life in order to attain success in a medical career. And it's a lot more humane.
Not everyone who reads this book will be considering a career in surgery. What do you want the rest of us to take away from these stories?
I think I would like, I was wondering what patients would think of this. So it's been interesting to hear what people have thought who are not surgeons. I think I would like you to know that we are human and we try to do the best we can, and that we do react to you on a human level, even though we may not always show it.
This collection of short stories has been, you published it independently, you published it yourself. Why did you choose to take that path?
I had done 9 textbooks with conventional publishers, and I had sporadically approached agents about taking something like it. It's a very difficult time to get a short story collection published. And when I talked to agents, they seemed to want someone who would be the next Dr. Oz, or, you know, be a real TV radio celebrity. And I just wanted to get my short stories out. And we live in a world now where you can self-publish and get things out. There are ways to do it through the internet. And so I just did it. And it's been a fascinating experience. I have to say that one of the things that's been eye-opening for me in this whole experience of publishing the book is really the role of independent bookstores and our own Prairie Lights in the intellectual life of a community. Because I'd been familiar with Prairie Lights as a reader, but as a writer, they've almost been kind of like an incubator for this book, and they've helped me get the word out. They've helped me connect with people. And
having self-published and done these appearances yourself, obviously, at Prairie Lights and other places in the state, as someone who has a career where you need to be invulnerable in many ways, has this been a very vulnerable experience for you to share these personal stories and to see people face to face who are reading them or hearing them for the first time?
Yes, it really has been. It's been interesting interacting with patients who have read the book, and it's been interesting fielding questions about the book. There are a couple questions that tend to recur. People ask about the cats. They want to know if that was real, and most of that was real, and so forth and so on. But the response has been very hearteningly positive. I think that it seems like I managed to tread the line I was trying to tread.
Dr. Carol Scott Connor, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
The book is called A Few Small Moments. Dr. Carol Scott Connor is a professor of surgery at the University of Iowa. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. Our production assistant today is Emily Woodbury. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, the Silos and Smokestacks National Heritage Area, some new additions. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR.